headlines. The U.S. President's National Security Advisor says that he will ensure a smooth transition to Democrat Joe Biden if he's deemed the winner of the presidential election. New York Times report says U.S. President Donald Trump was considering attacking an Iranian nuclear facility last week. Also in the headlines, Qatar says the normalization of ties with Israel by some Arab states undermines efforts for Palestinian statehood. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. U.S. President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor says that Joe Biden is deemed to be the winner of the November 3rd presidential election.
There is a new administration. Like, they deserve some time to come in and implement their policies. We may have policy disagreements, but look, if the Biden-Harris ticket is determined to be the winner, and it's, you know, obviously things look that way now, we'll have a very professional transition from the National Security Council. There's no question about it.
O'Brien stressed that there will be a smooth transition of power if Biden is confirmed president. He said very professional folks would take positions at the White House in the Biden administration. Nearly 2 weeks after the U.S. presidential vote, incumbent Trump has refused to concede. He insists that his Democratic rival Biden has won because the election was rigged. Trump's stance has sparked tensions between the Republican and Democratic camps. It has also triggered demonstrations by supporters of both Trump and Biden. Edward Corrigan is an international lawyer who joins us. Edward Corrigan, do you believe what the National Security Advisor of Trump has said means that at least his team has accepted the fact that Trump has lost?
Yes, I believe that most of his team has accepted that he's lost the election. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has spoken to him about making an announcement conceding. A number of other prominent Republicans, people in the administration, have also said the same thing. The National Security Advisor, by telegraphing the fact there will be a smooth transition if, in fact, Biden is declared the winner officially, that there will be a smooth transition. And that's sending a message from the national security apparatus, the Pentagon, etc., that they will support the transition of power from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. So, yes, it's a clear signal. Many generals and admirals and stuff also came out publicly in favor of Joe Biden. Former members of the head of the CIA, former national security advisors. In fact, former Republican presidents came out against Donald Trump in favor of Joe Biden. So what we're seeing here is, maybe a bit of a delusion on the part of Trump that he could still somehow win the election. But even if he wins and overturns Arizona and Georgia, he's still short. Biden has, actually by my calculation, if you include Georgia, he's got 306 electoral college votes compared to Trump's 232. Sorry, and so there's no way that even if they flip Arizona or flip Georgia or flip both of them, that they have enough electoral college votes to overturn the election. Trump has been sort of making a campaign and trying to prevent and even sabotage the postal system because he knows the higher the turnout is, and in particular with mail-in ballots, that they go overwhelmingly for the Democrats. So Trump did everything in his power to fight them, except he was arguing when he was ahead, they had to immediately stop counting the ballots. But when he was behind, he also wanted to continue to counting the ballots, so he thought he might catch. He's just playing, a game. But there is a logic to what Trump is doing. Trump is trying to invigorate the base. He's trying to still fundraise money to pay off the debt, quite frankly, for the election, and also to raise money for the fight in Georgia, because there's still two Senate positions that have to be determined. If the Democrats win both of them, then actually they would have control of the Senate. It would be like a 50-50 split with the vice president having the deciding vote. I mean, that's as close as it could possibly come. But really what they're doing is trying to raise money. And if you look at the fine print, it says that that small donations are not necessarily going to go to pay the debt. They're setting up a war fund to fund these lawsuits. But I think they lost 23 out of 24, so they're getting almost nowhere on the lawsuits. In fact, a lot of the big law firms are withdrawing because they got nothing to say. You're complaining there weren't observers, but then you admit there were observers and stuff. So everything has gone against him. I heard that he did win one lawsuit, but I don't know what the facts are, and I don't think it would make a difference if he wins the one lawsuit. He's not going to get anything up to the Supreme Court, which I think was his ultimate wish. But they're trying to raise money for a super PAC that Trump wants to control, and also for the National Republican Committee, and then for this Georgia election, and doing it. So he's trying to raise money that he will control, and the fear is that he'll actually siphon it, and has maybe already siphoned a lot of money into his businesses, because he's got, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of debt that are coming due very soon. So this will keep Trump in the game, generalizing, you know, invigorating his base, and of course raising tens of millions of dollars that he could use in a PAC for his own personal purposes, or, you know, and to manipulate to increase his power within the Republican Party, even though he is a defeated candidate. And usually the defeated candidates, disappear.
Right.
It's rare. Nixon came back after one defeat, but that's, I think, the only example I can think of. There's people run a couple times. However, so it's a big scam, really, that Trump is trying to still raise money and still milk his base, saying, oh, we didn't lose the election, we won, we're still going to fight on in Georgia. But he's really trying to pay down his debt and increase his own power and to have a lot of money at his disposal that he can continue to manipulate the policy. And also, it's a big blow to his ego that he lost. He can't believe that this is true. But he is has a personality disorder. He's extremely narcissistic and doesn't want to lose, and, you know, has a terrible record of losing, even though he's lost many, many times over his life in businesses and things. He's got tons of bankruptcies, you know, divorces, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, this is really, I think, a scam that they're trying to milk the kid Trump's base for as much money as they can before he officially leaves the scene. And the chances of him overturning the election, I think, are like, you know, 0.1%.
Thank you very much for that. Edward Corrigan, international lawyer there. U.S. President Donald Trump has reportedly asked his top aides about the possibility of striking Iran's nuclear facilities. According to the New York Times, Trump floated the idea last Thursday during a meeting with his close aides. They included the Vice President, the Secretary of State, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, among others. Officials dissuaded Trump by warning him that an attack on Iran could escalate into a broader regional conflict in the last weeks of his presidency. The U.S. President has unleashed a campaign of threats and sanctions against Tehran since he pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal back in 2018. Iran in September warned that a U.S. military action would be a strategic mistake and pledged to give a decisive response. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. gives us more details about the backdrop to Trump's meeting on a strike on Iran.
Many people believe that the president was thinking of doing this as a distraction from what is happening now, and that is a failure to concede the loss of the presidential election and to engage in a transition with President-elect Joe Biden. And one thing is for certain, if the president were to carry out any type of military strike, it would make things much more difficult for the president-elect to continue the transition. And it would definitely make the headlines distracting from the chaos that the president is creating by reluctantly wanting to concede the race. This is definitely something that senior advisors and officials dissuaded the president from doing. And in fact, when the president suggested a military strike, they talked to him and spoke to him and told him how much the wider repercussions would lead to further disaster and problems for the United States, meaning that this would be a bigger problem for the United States than it may be for Iran, or maybe it would be equally problematic for both countries. They left the conversation thinking that this idea was tabled and that the president would not carry through with it. But we do know that the president can be somewhat mercurial when it comes to his decision making. But because of the advice from senior officials and senior advisors, and the fact that there is a president-elect coming in January to become president, it's largely believed that this would not be something that would come to fruition, and that is a military strike on Iran.
Iran's envoy to the UN says the Security Council is dominated and taken advantage of by Western nations. In a speech to the UN General Assembly on reforming the Council, Majid Tahir Avanchi said the body's composition is currently undemocratic, as it lacks a strong presence by developing nations. He added that any reform of the council must encompass the interests of all UN members. Dr. Awanchi went on to say that the 15-member council is facing a crisis of legitimacy and credibility due to its poor, passive, and in some cases, illegal and extra-legal decisions. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says that any reform of the U.S. Security Council would be a difficult process since the U.S. and Russia are unwilling to relinquish their veto rights.
The Security Council was designed to control the organization, the U.N. When it was set up after the Second World War, the only way that the Russians and the Americans would join the U.N. was if they had permanent position on the Security Council and a veto power. So essentially the same objections that have been brought to the fore now and have been repeatedly in the past are the reasons that you've got a participation by the Americans and at the time the Soviet Union, but now the Russians. And they threw in the French and the British, essentially, because they were allies of the Americans. So what I'm trying to say is that it's difficult historically. It's difficult to see the Americans and the Russians staying in the UN without control, without some sort of veto control.
Latar says the normalization of ties with Israel by some Arab states undermines efforts for Palestinian statehood.
I think it's better to have a united front and to have to put the interest of the Palestinian people to end the occupation and to recognize the two-state solution and to go back to the borders of 1967 with an independent sovereign state of Palestine, with the capital East Jerusalem, as all the international resolution stating. And this is the solution and the vision that Qatar is looking for. We want to see negotiations happening between the Israelis and the Palestinians to put an end for this conflict, because the Palestinian people, they are the ones who are paying for this conflict.
The Qatari foreign minister added that the Arab world can gain leverage over Israel by presenting a united front and that divisions will not be in the interest of the Palestinians. His reaction came in response to the U.S. brokered deals under which the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan agreed to establish ties with Israel. The move was met with fierce condemnation from across the Muslim world. Sudan's Information Minister Faisal Mohammed Saleh has revealed that U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Paul Arudi with the Free Palestine Movement says the normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel is aimed at undercutting the future of a Palestinian state.
The United States and Israel intended to undermine the future Palestinian state and to undermine the ongoing suppression of the Palestinians so that eventually they would be of no importance. So this is the objective of Israel. Qatar has always had a certain amount of independence. For example, its decision to have a different policy, foreign policy, than its very big neighbor, Saudi Arabia. And it has, as a result, at least explored more friendly relations with Iran. So Qatar is basically saying, first of all, we're not joining you, and we are an independent nation, and we'll decide ourselves what we're going to do, and we prefer to stay loyal to our brothers in Palestine.
Thousands of Armenians have once again hit the streets of the capital Yerevan to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. Protesters marched to the streets chanting Nikol is a traitor. Yerevan has witnessed several such protests since Pashinyan signed a ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan to end the fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The ceasefire announced on November the 10th secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan into the region. Pashinyan himself called the deal a disaster, but said that he had no choice but to sign it to stave off a defeat. The Russia-brokered truce halted military action in and around the region. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeeping troops are now deployed to the region to monitor the ceasefire. A new scandal has hit the British Labour Party, this time involving rampant Islamophobia within its ranks. A new report has made several shocking discoveries, which appear to show the hatred of Muslims is at an all-time high, but the response to the findings has been lukewarm. Rob Carter brings us the details.
Members of the Labour Party star.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively, while 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the counsellors I've experienced, the talking I've had, conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and a large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
India has posted over 29,000 new coronavirus infections in the past 24 hours. That is the lowest number of daily COVID cases since mid-July. According to the Health Ministry, the figure brings India's total confirmed cases to over 8.8 million. Daily infections have fallen there since hitting a peak in September, but experts have warned that a festival held at the weekend could lead to a new spike. In South Korea, a recent surge in daily cases has prompted authorities to impose stricter social distancing rules for the greater Seoul area. The restrictions will start on Tuesday night. They came as daily infections surpassed 200 for a fourth straight day. Officials have warned of a bigger crisis if the current curves fail. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Marisa Cloud, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and a corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprising raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film. And I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking? And
yeah.
That it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on cameras. The fly, and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get that. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine. But they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protests firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest.
And Marie, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that was its nature, and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but I that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you're plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. what we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? Absolutely. Do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. The first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protesters and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. they're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, and maybe the interactive part, this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, was trying to converse with a police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
Yeah,
and I'd like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. Or I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they, one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest. And sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we've just said. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, violence, of course this should happen. It said, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
Yeah, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kungler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovi so, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Maurice, what do you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short-term, changing the mayor and, removing the radar cameras.
Some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film, therefore, has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. There was someone talking about the social, the community type change that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involves someone's talking about family history that they've started discussing since the protest. I think that that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protests? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the document is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen in New York? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and I had no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, the anatomy of a protest, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
It's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Kamila Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam
by Tahir Reza Jafar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Welcome to another episode of For Humanity, a program in which we look at the beautiful treatise of rights from Imam Zainul Abidin عليه السلام. And we find that in this treatise of rights, the Imam has mentioned the rights and responsibilities of every individual we may encounter in our daily lives. We are currently discussing the rights of the mas'ul, haqqul mas'ul, that is the person who is asked, the person who is approached by beggars in order to beg, in order to ask from him. And just as the beggar himself, the sa'il, the asker, has rights, the one who is being asked also has certain rights. We know that there has been a lot of emphasis and a lot of encouragement given to charity and to giving people, helping people with one's wealth. But at the same time, there has been equal emphasis to avoid begging. This is a very important aspect that we need to discuss. Of course, we are talking about the right of the one who is asking, but we should realize that even the one who is being asked may one day turn to a position where he has to ask. So it is important for us to realize that while Islam encourages giving and charity, it discourages begging and asking. To this end, we find, for example, many traditions have reached us. One tradition states, "Al-mas'alatu miftahul faqr." Begging and asking others for help is the key to poverty. A person should not think that by asking other people that you will obviously become richer. No, once you get into the habit of begging and asking, you are actually unlocking the door of poverty, and you will end up becoming more poor and lose your wealth by this action of depending on others and asking others. In one tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, "As-su'alu yud'ifu lisan al-mutakallim wa yaksiru قلب الشجاع البطل ويوقف الحر العزيز موقف العبد الذليل ويذهب بهاء الوجه ويمحق الرزق." Here you find that Imam Ali alayhi salam is mentioning all the negative consequences of asking, of begging, of depending on others, of seeking from others. He says, asking others has certain negative consequences, the first of which is it makes a person weak. It weakens the speech of the person. يُضْعِفُ لِسَانَ الْمُتَكَلِّمِ The speaker who is asking for something, that person cannot speak with confidence. He trembles. He is scared as he begs because he knows that one wrong word from him would remove any hope of attaining what he seeks from the person whom he is asking. So he is asking with a lot of fear, and this weakens him. The second is وَيَكْسِرُ قَلْبَ الشُّجَاعِ الْبَطَلِ When a person is even courageous and heroic, still when he has to ask somebody for something, then it breaks his heart, because now you are lowering yourself in front of someone else. You are putting yourself in a position where someone else is higher than you. So even if you are a courageous and heroic individual, still, the moment you have to ask for something, you have to beg for something, then you are breaking your heart and you are breaking that courage that you have within you. That is the second negative consequence. The third is وَيُوقِفُ الْحُرَّ الْعَزِيزِ مَوْقِفَ الْعَبْدِ الذَّلِيلِ It turns the respected free person into one who is like an abased slave, one who is like a lowly slave. So, you know, obviously in the society at the time of the Prophet and the A'imma alayhim as-salam, people were of two kinds. There were free people and there were slaves. The slaves were those who had no volition and they had no choice in the way they lived their lives. They had to live as their masters dictated to them. And so a slave was somebody who had no control over his own destiny, over his own life. And many times, therefore, slaves yearned for freedom and they tried in different ways to earn their freedom. And so once a slave was freed, that was the biggest achievement he or she could attain in their life. So freedom has great value. The Imam alayhi salam says that when you beg from someone, when you ask someone for assistance, then you, even if you are a free person with your own dignity and respect, the moment you beg, the moment you ask, you turn into someone who is like a slave, a lowly slave. Because now you have put yourself in a position where someone else has power over you. That person can either give you what you need or can deprive you and leave you suffering as you are. And so this is the third negative consequence of begging or asking. The fourth is وَيُذْهِبُ بَهَاءَ الْوَجْهِ And when you beg, when you ask, the dignity that you have dissipates. Now you no longer have any respect or dignity because you are degrading yourself by asking someone else. And finally, وَيَمْحَقُ الرِّزْقُ When you ask, you lose your sustenance. A person who begs others loses his rizq. His rizq, his sustenance becomes less. It reduces. Why? Because one of the ways of increasing one's sustenance is by depending solely upon Allah Azza wa Jal, by having faith and trust in Allah Azza wa Jal. When you have trust in Allah, the Quran also says, وَمَنْ يَتَوَكَّلَ عَلَى اللَّهِ فَهُوَ حَسْبُهُ Whoever has complete trust in Allah, Allah is sufficient for that person. But now when you put your trust and your dependence on someone else, then your sustenance reduces. So these are the negative consequences of asking. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal to grant us the ability to avoid asking others. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity by Brother Taher Reza Jafar. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is His messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.